Usually in Islamic discourse, one begins with the name of God, Allah. But one could begin with the name as a Dao that cannot be named. And that shows exactly where Confucianism and Islam meet at the highest level of reality. Today I'm going to speak to you for about half an hour about both the history of this dialogue and the history of the relationship between Confucianism and Islam, or China and the Islamic world in another sense, and also some of the points which I think have both been discussed before and are bound to be of great importance in the future dialogue between two civilizations. It was 48 years ago, 38 years ago, excuse me, when I met Chu Weiming in India, when the great Indian philosopher and scholar of global philosophy, Eastern West, Mahadevan, had created a very important conference in Madras, which many distinguished scholars of both East and West, including some Western Islamists such as Vigyate and of India, Olivia Lacombe, people like that were invited to the leading European scholars. And Mahadevan and I were friends, and at that time I lived in the vicinity of that area. I'm a Persian, Iranian by origin. I was living in Iran at that time, so it was not too far distance. He would come and go to Iran often. He said, one afternoon, he said, there's a young Chinese scholar I want you to meet. He's very gifted. And at that time, it was the height of communist China and Maoism and so forth. I had no interest whatsoever in a young communist kid in the school of philosophy. But I was utterly surprised when I met my dear friend, Chu Weiming. We became friends, and I saw in him a very precocious mind, interested in global issues, philosophy in its global sense, in which both of us have been interested all our life. And we associated with each other a great deal. As far as this dialogue is concerned between Islam and Confucianism, although we had a discussion of it in Beijing a few months ago, I think it was the only one on the surface of the earth who could have pulled me to come all the way to China, but I did. And we had a wonderful time together. But nevertheless, I think it needs some repeating here, because it's really a very important moment in modern intellectual history. It was in 1990, thereabouts, I don't remember, 89, 90, something like that, maybe 91. Professor Chu Weiming and I were participating together in Honolulu in a conference. At that time, we were both editors of volumes of the Encyclopedia World Spirituality. He was in charge of the Confucian volumes, and I of the Islamic volumes. And this is one race in which the Muslims meet the Chinese. I brought up my two volumes, and it took a long time to complete, but we were in discourse all the time together. And one evening, after a long, long day, he told me, he said, look, this is a paper. I want you to go and take a look at it. This is not only a scholarly paper, but it's a position paper for political action. And this was the original essay of Samuel Huntington, which appeared later on in Foreign Affairs, before the book came out, Clash of Civilizations. I was very tired, but nevertheless, between 9 and 11 o'clock in the evening, I read very, very carefully this text. And the next morning, I told him how disturbed I was by this text. I said this was a very dangerous idea. And especially there, he mentions that the great danger for the West was an alliance between Islamic and Chinese civilizations that he saw as the great danger. And we spoke about this and said, let's do something about it. Let's start having a dialogue together because of, as I told him, I told everybody for decades, usually in the Orient, whenever you have a dialogue between you and the West, the different Orients very rarely have a dialogue with each other. When you say in India, East and West, that means India and Western Europe. When you're in China, it's China and Western Europe. But between China, India, the Islamic world, the Buddhist world, the Malay world, and so forth, and so on, very little dialogue. This is a remnant of colonialism, of course, the form of colonialistic way of thinking. So there's never been actually a serious dialogue between Islam and Confucianism in modern times. So the first idea of having this dialogue was incubated really the next morning at breakfast at the University of Hawaii. It just happened after that I went to Malaysia. And Malaysia is one of the two Islamic countries in which there's a very large Chinese presence, the other being Indonesia. But in Malaysia, it's even more important because 35% of the population is of Chinese origin. Some are Christian, but many of them are Confucians, Taoists, and Buddhists. And there's no other country in the world in which you have a 35% to 56-57% Confucian Muslim population. At that time, the Deputy Prime Minister of Malaysia was Anwar Ibrahim, former student, my friend of mine, and he had organized a lecture which about 2,000 people had come, including all the ministers in the cabinet and professors and president of universities, and there I spoke about this text of Huntington. It was the first time the Islamic world ever heard about the term class of civilizations. And I said that with my dear friend Fu Weiming, we hope that we can start having a dialogue among ourselves in order to prevent clash of civilization. Why have clash? Why not have understanding? And that led to the very first conference that was held in Malaysia on this theme. Unfortunately, I was not able to attend, but two of my dear friends, colleagues, and former students, who are my very best students, William Chidek and Sachko Murata, who happen to be married to each other, I told them, you go in my place. And they went. They went, and there are a number of Chinese scholars also with an interest in Islamic studies who were present, and this began the process that led in 1994 to a conference which was a two-way meeting organized at Harvard University, in which he led a number of Chinese scholars, a number of Muslim scholars, and he had a very, very important several-day meeting there pursuing this theme. And from there on, it has gone on, and it's not only been talk. Sachko Murata, who is Japanese and who knows Chinese, with her husband, the leading scholar of Islamic studies, a wonderful master of both Persian and Arabic, and with the Tu Weiming, the leading authority of Confucian thought, they made up a team. I acted as referee, blowing the whistle when the football was going there, I'd register up. But we met once a year together at the house of the Chiteks on Long Island and spent some days together and some occasion at Harvard, but it was day three. I said I was much more of an asset. I'm not a synologue, synologist, but I got hurt a little bit, especially on the Islamic side of things. Anyway, a book came out on Sufism in China, followed by this major, major work of Yuxi. The first book was by Wang Lanyu. The second one, which is Sage and Learning, which is a 600-700 page book, which the Harvard University Press brought out, which is one of the great masterpieces of scholarship of recent years, which is a fruit of this dialogue. So, fortunately, this is going on. When I was in Beijing a few months ago, and the two of us had dialogue during Beijing on this issue, there was unbelievable interest, both among students and faculty and the public at large, of the articles written about it all over the place. Now, gradually in China itself, the importance of the tradition of what's called the Han Kitab is becoming better known. This tradition, which began in the 17th century with the translation of Islamic thought for the first time into Chinese. It's remarkable that the Quran was not translated into Chinese until the 19th century, whereas the first mosques in China go back to the 7th and 8th century. The Muslim population did not want to have the Quran translated into Chinese. But in the 17th century, a new intellectual movement began, led by people like Li Shi and Wang Dayu and others, who were masters of Arabic and Persian, at the same time were masters of Confucian learning and classical Chinese, and very much attracted to Neo-Confucianism. Yu Shi and people like that in the 13th century was a much more expansive exposition of Confucian teachings, what is usually known in the West as Neo-Confucianism. And these two began to produce Islamic works in Chinese using Chinese concepts and terms, but corresponding to the Islamic reality. And the first texts that they chose were also the texts by Abdurrahman Jami and Nasafi and people like that, Persian Sufis of the centuries just before the 13th and 14th, but around there. Of course, Jami belonged to the 15th century, but Nasafi belonged to the 13th century. Anyway, that itself was a very important event, and that has led and helped to lead to this idea of the importance of Islamic Confucian dialogue. Now, before I turn to the few points that have helped, are very important. So let me just remind ourselves, especially for those who are Americans who don't know this part of the history very well, China and the Islamic world, and before Islam came, the Persian Empire, which was then became the eastern part of the Islamic world, had not only the geographical contiguity, but very, very long historical exchange going into prehistory. The making of steel, the process of making of steel, came from the Iranian plateau to China, God knows where, perhaps 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. Silkworms and mulberry trees and the production of silk went from China to Persia, and from there to the Arab world, and the famous medieval brocades of Syria that were so expensive in Venice ultimately came back from the Chinese technology which had come into the Islamic world. The Persian word for paper, kaghaz, not Arabic, kaghaz, the Persian word kaghaz still comes from Chinese, the Chinese word, and the technology of paper making and the tremendous impact it had upon learning came from China to Persia. When the Mongols captured both of these worlds, not the whole of the Islamic world, but the eastern part of the Islamic world and China, when their cousins ruling over Persia and China, there was remarkable intellectual and scientific exchange. There were Chinese scientists in Tabriz, there were Persian scientists in Beijing. When the great wazir, the grand wazir, the prime minister of the Ilkhanids, Rashiduddin Fazlullah, established what's called Rashidi outside of Tabriz, which was the first university city in known history, long before the Soviets decided to build one outside of Moscow. The whole city devoted simply to learning. He invited a large number of Chinese scholars, and the first treatise on acupuncture that we have in the Islamic world is not a modern one. There are acupuncture places in Tehran and all over the place, but it goes back to the 14th century, to the 14th century manuscript from Tabriz, which I've seen in my own eyes, on Chinese acupuncture, but even showing the needles and all of these things that shows that it was done by someone who knew what it was talking about. It was necessarily theoretical, the art of practicing acupuncture and astronomy and so on, but not burden you. But these two civilizations, both in pre-Islamic and Islamic period for this side, and the whole Chinese tradition going back to the Emperor Yu, God knows when, prehistory, have had contact constantly with each other. And also, it's very important to note for the dynamics of the present Chinese Islamic dialogue, at the heart of the Chinese being, of course, Confucian. The fact, which is bitter to mention, but nevertheless has to mention, is that Chinese or Confucian Islamic relations have never had a 1492. That had changed the whole dynamic. Some of you are wondering what I'm alluding to. In the dialogue between Islam and the West, the expulsion of Muslims by force, or the forced conversion, or they were put to death after 1492 when the last Islamic center of power in Granada was destroyed, that has left a tremendous blemish on the dialogue that goes on. There are many mountains that have to be crossed and surmounted, you might say. Such a thing does not exist in with China. It's true. The week I was in Beijing, 8 Uyghurs were hanged in Xinjiang. By the same time, the main mosque in Beijing, which is 800 years old, it's had 800-year continuous history, was full on Friday. Went there for prayers, and there were thousands of hundreds of God knows how many people in the mosque. And the fact that they have not been this shock is very, very important in the future of the relationship between Islam and China, and especially dialogue between Islam and Confucianism. Now, this is a vast and new field. It's very rare now, late in human history, to discover a whole new continent, intellectual continent. But it has been discovered. And its major capitals, one of them is sitting here, is Tu Weiming, and such as Murata, Chitik, others. There are a number of other scholars, the American scholars, and now some other Chinese scholars are coming into the field. And I believe that this would be one of the most fecund dialogues that can go on the globe. It incorporates a little bit less than 3 billion people. There are 1.5 billion Muslims, over 1.3 billion Chinese. Of course, there's an overlap, about 100 million, some people say, tens of millions, others say, are Muslims within China. But nevertheless, a very large number of the human population, of the human collectivity. I mean, even the word human race, because we have more than one race. There's no such thing as human race. The human race says, technically speaking, that's why usually I avoid using that term. Now, when we deal with the Confucian tradition, of course, the Chinese Muslims who before wrote about it can be a very, very important guide for the rest of the Muslims. And throughout history, it was the eastern lands of Islam, especially Persia and Central Asia, that were so much aware of the Chinese presence in North Africa and the Arab East. The awareness was not that great. Although it was the Prophet of Islam who said, "Utlib al-ilm wa al-basin, seek knowledge even if it be in China." So it was something as aware of that land far away. But for the eastern land of Islam, it wasn't that far away. But nevertheless, it's this arrowhead of pioneers of Muslim Chinese scholars writing about Confucianism that is very, very precious for the Islamic side. I'm sure the books that Ian Chittick and Sachiko have done are going to translate into Persian almost immediately. I don't know whether they'll be translated into Arabic or not, but these days it's Persian and Turkish that are really the main carriers of everything that's occurring intellectually, unfortunately, more than Arabic. And unfortunately for these two languages, unfortunately for Arabic. But it's certainly going to come out in Persian, and the first book is already out in Persian, and in Turkish. And the other way around also, this Han Kitab tradition can be very, very important for the Chinese Confucian side. As there is now more and more revival of interest in Confucianism in China itself, the period of the Cultural Revolution is over, and there are many important young scholars who are interested in this subject. You cannot imagine the intensity of interest that young students at the premier university of China, the University of Peking, when he and I had this dialogue together about Confucianism and Islam. I was really astounded. So we have this movement going on both sides. And I believe there are a number of points, although they have been discussed on the basis of my own suggestion and to Weiming's suggestion before, but are going to discuss also in the future. I just want to point to show how rich this dialogue can be. Let me start with the beginning, metaphysics, ultimate reality. There's a remarkable similarity, in fact, in a sense of unanimity, of how the supreme principle, reality per se, is understood in the Neo-Confucian and Islamic philosophical and mystical and Gnostic traditions. It was not just as a joke that I said, let's begin the name and the Tao that cannot be named. The late Toshiko Izutsu, the famous Japanese scholar, wrote a wonderful book called Sufism and Taoism. And if such a book were to be written for Sufism and your Confucianism, in the same way that he tried to approach thematically the major issues of metaphysics, the universal man, nature, and so forth, we see how at the highest level, although Confucianism is usually identified with ethics, but the later new Confucian tradition, which is one of the richest metaphysical traditions we have in traditional philosophies, how at the highest level the remarkable similarities, although of course the Tao is an impersonal understanding of the divinity, and in Islam as in all Abrahamic religions, the personal aspect of divinity also comes in as very important. But metaphysically, that stuff does not really pose a problem, because Allah is at once personal and metapersonal. Divine essence is beyond every conception, including that of the person. And so in a sense, the two traditions can begin from the same place. Then we have the field of cosmology. It's here that I think you have a very, very rich tradition on both sides, which is not only of historical interest. I've been writing over 50 years about this issue. I did my PhD thesis at Harvard in the 50s on this issue, and published with Harvard University Press called Introduction to Islamic Cosmology, which is still, unfortunately, after 50 years, the only book on the subject that is read. I wish something else had been written and be read. But anyway, some of you may have seen it. There I've mentioned 50 years ago, I mentioned now. Traditional cosmologies are not simply childish steps toward the development of mature modern cosmology. Modern cosmology is another discipline. The only relation it has to traditional cosmology is the name. Because the modern cosmology is an extension of modern physics. It's really extrapolation of terrestrial physics, astrophysics, and all of the laws that it presumes are really terrestrial laws, which we observe extrapolated to way out there in the heavens. Whereas traditional cosmology deals with levels of being. Being is not confined only to the physical, to the quantitative, and so you have this very rich Chinese cosmology in many different schools. It's not only Neo-Confucian, the Buddhists and Taoists, of course, remarkable cosmologies, but all of them have, again, incredible similarities to schemes of Islamic cosmology, and the Sage of Learning and other books like this, in fact, point these out. So we have a similarity of the worlds in which traditional China and traditional Islam breathe. Because traditional cosmology depicts the world in which we live, in the largest sense of the term. And so it's extremely important existentially, it's not only a theoretical subject. Then you have, of course, what everybody talks about confusion about ethics. And needless to say, both the Islamic tradition and the Confucian tradition play a very important, place a very important price upon the importance of, upon ethics, of centrality of ethics in human life, both personal and social. That's obvious, but there's one point that we need to work on a lot more on both sides. I hope in future dialogues, the new institute now that Dr. Pu Ming has it in the University of Beijing, and that would be a very good place to do it, is the following. We have lost, except for a few fringe creatures, the relationship between human ethics and cosmic events. The two are no longer related. Even in the West, in the old days, if there was an earthquake, people would think that is a punishment for people's sins. There was a relationship between human action and cosmic events. This has been totally lost, thanks to modern science. Nobody talks about it anymore in the mainstream. But the very interesting is yesterday is the Washington Post. A number of articles, is there a moral dimension to the destruction of the Gulf of Mexico? I suggest that you read that, because it brings out this issue again, because of this unbelievable catastrophe that human beings have caused as a result of worshiping the god of technology, which nobody is willing to criticize. No one is willing to criticize his gods, the sacrifices we make, blood sacrifices at his feet. Now, Confucianism and Islam, in contrast, emphasize always that human ethics is not divorced from the cosmos, from cosmic laws, and the cosmic dimension to it. And it is in light of that that both Professor Tuvenning and Mircea Eliade, the great Romanian scholar of religion, coined the term anthropocosmic man. He wrote some years back that at the center of Confucian thought is the idea of anthropocosmic man. That is, man, of course, means mensch, deer, not just a male. The human being, man, in that sense, both male and female, is not only a biological terrestrial being confined to its social and human, what they call human relations, but has a cosmic dimension to it. There is an interrelationship between us and the cosmos. And in fact, the two realities cannot be separated. And that's what's called anthropocosmic. And this is totally against the grain of everything that modern thought has taught since the Renaissance, in which we are pulled as an island outside of nature, independent of nature, to dominate nature, and find, of course, nature is going to take good care of us at the end. We haven't got to the end yet, but we're getting there very fast. This idea is shared as the anthropocosmic reality between China and, or Confucianism and also Taoism, and Islamic thought. And this is something that must be pursued, because this is directly to the question of the environment. Of course, the environmental crisis is a global crisis. The main responsibility lies at the feet of the civilization that created modern technology, secularized the world, and believed that the role of technology is the total domination of the world, as Western civilization, which first began to pollute the rivers, Thames River, long before the Ganges was polluted or the Yangtze was polluted. But it's in the 19th century, everybody shares, of course, the responsibility. You cannot blame the tremendous environmental crisis in China and anybody else but the Chinese. And the same for India, cutting up over half of the forests of the Himalayas. Over half of the forests of the Himalayas have already been cut. The Ganges River is dying. You cannot blame that on Americans in Louisiana. But indirectly, of course, if you look at the whole historical process, there is a great deal of blame for those who created this worldview with which they were able to dominate the other civilization, which then tried to become independent, and therefore follow the very acts, very steps that leads to the suicide. Now, the idea of the anthropocosmic man, I believe, has a very important impact upon the question of the environmental crisis. I know that a country like Communist China, which is formally at least still Marxist and communist, is very difficult to talk about the spiritual crisis that underlies the environmental crisis, something which I've spoken about for half a century. But nevertheless, there are many, many people who are aware of that this is more than just a question of bad engineering. In the Islamic world also, we're having tremendous environmental crisis. In one form or another, I don't want to criticize other countries, the country from which I come, Iran. I did an interview with the leading newspaper in Tehran 2 days ago on this issue. Because of the tremendous crisis that is going on in different places, this blind sacrifice before this new god, the god of Fan, of Indian Persian, the modern technology, which has made people so impervious to its consequences. So you might say the whole world, but especially the Islamic Chinese world, which are next to each other, are in the same boat as far as this is concerned. And the two civilizations which are among the worst to suffer the consequences of the environmental crisis in one way or another. The Africans are much more in a passive way. They're at the receiving end of things. But a place like Saudi Arabia, with all the oil money and what they've done with the oil money and destruction of so much of the traditional architecture and the traditional irrigation and agriculture and the Punjab and the Iran and so forth and so on, a long, long story. So the two civilizations have a model for being able to deal with what is surely the most difficult and the most immediate and urgent crises of our world, that is the environmental crisis, which I hope at least is unbelievable tragedy of the last few days, proves to people that it's not going to be solved by having complete reliance on the technology, which up and down does not what it's doing. At least to stop this worship and try to use our minds. And I'm not saying that the problem is confined to the Islamic world and China. I'm not saying that the solution is confined to them. But nevertheless, these two civilizations are both sitting and a very, very rich tradition, which goes back to the idea of the anthropocosmic man, the cosmic dimension of our existence, our duty towards nature as part of ourselves, and the fact that no man is an island unto himself, as John Donne said. Thank you. Let me first thank Professor Iden to introduce both of us, and of course it's both a pleasure and honor to meet Professor Nasser again to share on the same platform. And I will offer basically a footnote to what is elaborated in such an eloquent way. I think the reason that I would like to establish an institute for advanced humanistic studies, the number of reasons, one of the most important reasons is to develop a center for dialogue among civilizations. And I made a deliberate attempt that a center, instead of involving the East-West dialogue, which is totally unavoidable, basically a dialogue with the Islamic world and with India. And of course, the West is always in the background, sometimes in a positive way. It's not totally negative, but often it's a threat that we need to recognize. I've been involved in a Chinese-Indian dialogue more recently. And we organized two meetings, one in Delhi, one in Beijing, on the theme of the Indian and Chinese philosophical reflections on knowledge, wisdom, and spirituality. Recognizing that China for a long time had been the beneficiary of Indian civilization through Buddhism. Without Buddhism, it's almost impossible to imagine the second epoch of Confucian humanism. But at the same time, we want to recognize, I think, almost approaching 100 million, but at least 80 million or so, Chinese Muslims, Chinese-speaking Muslims. But of course, Professor Nasser made a reference to the non-Chinese-speaking Muslims of the Uyghurs. And for a number of years, I've been involved in the Islamic-Confucian dialogue based upon the Chinese Muslims' experience. And we organized meetings in Nanjing first, and then after the meeting, and some of the Muslim scholars said, is this just a strategic move? It will be just a one-time event. I said, no, if I'm interested in something, it is long-term. Harvey and the Institute was involved. Then another meeting in Yinchuan, and then a meeting in Kunming, and most recently, there will be a meeting in Nanjing again. And two of Professor Nasser's most brilliant students continue, Satsiko Murata and Bill Shittig, continue to be involved. And in fact, their participation helped a new cosmopolitan dimension to that particular discourse. And this reminds me the four major thinkers, Muslim thinkers, Islamic thinkers, in the Confucian world in the 17th and 18th century. One, Wang Daiyu, but the more important one is Liu Zhi. We owe 5 years of work among ourselves, of course, with inspiration, continuous inspiration from Professor Nasser. We completed the work. To give you an example, both Chittick and Satchiko Murata live in Stony Brook, New York. And they would drive every time I was in Cambridge, sometimes it was not in Cambridge, but every time I was in Cambridge, they would drive for about 5 hours or six hours. And arriving Friday evening and staying with their good friend, Wolfgang Herrick, and the next day they would come to my home and we began reading the text together. And that lasted for about 3 years. And we finished the text. Very pleased, ready to put it into some kind of coherent fashion. But I chickened out. I said, well, we really have to go through it once more.
And they were a bit shocked. They said, well, another 3 years? I said, this time probably only two. But anyway, we went through it again. So when, of course, they were the major contributors because Chidi's seasoned understanding of the Islamic philosophy and Satoko Murata from Japan, interest in Japanese scholarship, classical Chinese, and of course the Islamic world. It's just the principal author, Chidi, the second one. I'm just supplementary to that team. And when we finished, I was impressed by a strategy. I don't want to use this word in an instrumental way. A strategy Liu Zhi, the great Muslim thinker in China, tried to use. The first attempt is to try to use a local knowledge to let it become globally significant within the Islamic world, within the Chinese world. In other words, the Muslim scholar wanted the major Confucian scholars in Nanjing to have some knowledge about a local knowledge basically developed by some of the major thinkers in the Islamic world within the Chinese cultural context. This is first. But the second one is much more important. That it is to introduce some of the most sensitive Confucian scholars to become aware of a much larger world, of the Islamic world, way beyond China, at the time, even way beyond the Persian legacy. And then the Chinese will become more cosmopolitan, in the best sense of the term. Unfortunately, the second attempt was not rightly recognized. As some of you know, it was the same period the Maharishi was in China, with Catholicism, and of course he spent about 13 years in Macau and mastered the language and then arrived in Nanjing. Liu Zhi and Wang Dainyu and Rishi lived in a period, lived in an area that was almost within walking distance. Even though the Muslim scholars were aware of what actually happened in the Christian world, and Rishi and his followers were totally ignorant about what happened in the Islamic world. And the distinctive feature of this, as Rishi came from Vatican, you know, under the influence of Vatican, basically wanted to transform Chinese into Christians. And of course, accommodating method was one of the important methods of doing it. Undeniably, he made a great contribution to introduce Western sciences to China and so forth. But Liu Zhi is raised in China, in the Persian community, but he mastered the language as part of the Sitting world. He's totally familiar. That's the reason he's able to try to understand Islam from within the Chinese cultural context and try to introduce Chinese scholars, especially Confucian scholars, to understand Islam as a fellow, quote, Confucians. So all these scholars, Wang Daiyu, Liu Zhi, Ma Zhu, Ma Beixing, were seasoned Confucian scholars. But at the same time, they're totally committed to their own faith, that Islamic tradition. So it's an internal dialogue. And I was just fascinated by reading his book to go through this dialogue. And it was eye-opening experience. And that's, therefore, I totally agree with Professor Nasser. There's a lot of points of convergence. Mutual learning becomes absolutely critical. But let me suggest one historical note or his historical background. That is the emergence of the Enlightenment mentality in the world. For a while, even today, it's one of the most powerful and influential ideologies in human history. There's some positive contributions, of course, controversial. The market economy, democratic policies, civil society, modern universities, and multinational corporations, or bureaucracies, all came out of this, both socialism and capitalism. And some values, these are great values actually, liberty, rationality, human rights, and dignity of the individual, due process of law. But it's a negative side, the shadow of enlightenment, and sometimes totally ignored by scholars in the West, and not even appreciated or understood by scholars in East Asia. because that mentality is basically anthropocentric and radically secular and extremely aggressive to its nature. As you know, Bacon considered knowledge as power rather than knowledge as wisdom. So to understand is not to appreciate. To understand is to control, to master. Therefore, this God, a new God of technology, emerged in a very powerful sense. And right now in China, I think one of the most powerful ideologies is scientism, the belief that the human ingenuity, social engineering will solve all the problems. And this has brought us to a major disaster. And the potential of this destructive power is obvious and very rarely totally recognized by both the intellectual and the political elite. That's an extremely difficult dilemma that we're confronted with. So the time is ripe for not only dialogues among civilizations, but the possibility of developing a dialogical civilization. That dialogical civilization is the contribution of all the great spiritual traditions, Islamic, Confucian, Taoist, Hindu, and so forth, to face up to this challenge. And I must say that some of the most sensitive and brilliant minds in the West have also become quite quickly aware of the fact that this is something we have to deal with. Ironically, people in East Asia and sometimes in the Islamic world will become so much overwhelmed by the Enlightenment mentality when some of the brilliant minds in the West begin to critique this tradition, and East Asian people begin to embrace it again and say the scientific development is something that we need to do at the expense of the environment and of the organic solidarity of the human community, a sense of meaning of life. A cosmology, as Professor Nasser pointed out, that is not simply an area of speculative metaphysics. It's a lived reality of understanding the human in both cosmological and anthropological terms. And this becomes a real challenge. And I hope our exchange will base upon some of these issues. And I will refer to the beginning of the Enlightenment in the 17th century and the major thinkers that shaped Enlightenment, such as Voltaire, Leibniz, and Diderot, Gani, and Aurelia Montaigne, were deeply impressed by the Confucian tradition. So they're indebted to the Confucian tradition and trying to develop a particular mode of thinking in the West. But from a historical perspective, we realize the move in the beginning seemed promising, but gradually it became totally immersed in a kind of hubris and in a kind of ignorance of understanding a larger world, especially the world of the cosmological order, the great cosmic transformation, the world of the transcendent, which is not simply out there, but which is a living reality here. And so we have a task, and it's extremely difficult. But I'm realistic. I'm not just romantic assertion about what we can do. So even just a little bit of transformation or transformative possibility, we'll be able to become a source of inspiration. That's the reason I think we all cherish the hope that these great minds, which shaped the meaningfulness of our world today, would reemerge as a source of inspiration for us to continue. And I would like to see another response from Professor Nasser. Thank you.
We can have more comments, or we'll also open the floor. One more question. Yes, please.
Actually, I have very little comment to make, and I am in agreement with the two-way Ming, except on one point, and that is a reappraisal of the Enlightenment mentality to which he alluded. And I believe that there needs to be a much more in-depth critique of that mentality which has led to the consequences that we're facing today than most Muslim or Chinese scholars have undertaken. This is a process that is not going on within the Islamic world. I do not know the Chinese world well enough to be able to comment upon it, but I think it's one of the prime duties of serious intellectuals and thinkers in both worlds to be able to provide an in-depth rather than simply fashionable understanding. For example, now that in the West you have deconstructionism and postmodernism, as certain critics of the Enlightenment, especially from France, well, and many people in the East are just emulating them, copying them, and tomorrow another wave is going to come out and something else will come. It's important that this critique be based upon our own intellectual traditions. Otherwise, I agree completely with what was to my meaning, and I hope that this process of being able to stand on our own feet in this incredible crisis that all of humanity is facing will continue. The new institute, I think, is going to play a very important role as far as China is concerned in this intercivilizational dialogue. I know it's quite natural that there should be close dialogue between India and China, concerning the importance of Buddhism, of course, but I think the dialogue between China and the Islamic world, from a geopolitical point of view, is even more important for the Chinese than it is for the Islamic world, and perhaps that will also push that dialogue as well.
Sometimes a little bit disagreement between friends is exciting. Let me look at the Chinese situation. To me, it's an agonizing situation. I don't look at it objectively. I can't. I look at it as a personal understanding. But I make a very clear distinction between personal and private. This is my private thought, I'm not going to share with anyone, such as my diary or my fanciful ideas. Personal meaning I'm experientially, existentially committed. And I think that view is discussable, arguable, hopefully publicly accountable, but also falsifiable. So this is my understanding of the Chinese case. Since the Opium War, the coming of the West, 1839, until the founding of the People's Republic in 1949, for that 110 years, this is Chinese experience different from the Islamic experience. Because I think in the Islamic world, the sense of cultural identity, the sense of being part of a different kind of universe, the assertion of our otherness, and as a critique of the West, the Chinese issue is different. So in that 110-year period, every 10 years there was a major change in the Chinese situation, not just cultural change, but social, political, economic change. After the founding of the People's Republic from 1949 to the reform open policy of 1979, we talk about 30 years. But every 5-year period, there's major transformation. The Korean War, followed by the Great Leap Forward, which turned out to be economically and politically disastrous. And then the 3 years of real famine, about 30 million, maybe even more, died of starvation, and then the Cultural Revolution, that the culture was wiped out. And then, of course, the later part of the Cultural Revolution, and Mao became such an aggressive and self-assertive force in transforming China totally at a tremendous expense of the Chinese, not the Chinese environment, the Chinese politics, for the Chinese soul. This is a very graphic image. Mao once said, if China becomes industrialized, like England, like other places, China then will be proud as a member of the international community. My vision, Mao's vision, is to stand on the Tiananmen and look beyond. So all the tea leaves of the industrial organizations will be there. Then I would consider China's made it. The idea of made it this industrialization with all the pollution that it would generate. And of course, there's no sensitivity to ecological problems. So with this kind of situation, the strategy to try to face up to the challenge will have to be two parts. The first part, you want to have some kind of communication with the intellectual and political elite. That communication involves what I would consider a sympathetic understanding. It's very difficult, it's painfully difficult. Sympathetic understanding what happened in the West. But more important is not that sympathetic understanding, it's only the first phase, but a critical reflection. And a critical reflection by mobilizing your indigenous traditions. And in so doing, you challenge the West, not from the point of view of the radical otherness, but of course radical otherness is important. The challenge in the West is say, I understand what actually happened. I can even appreciate some of the things you did. However, the particular kind of mentality which is now so powerful and so much embraced by East Asian minds, we have to be not only undermined, but we have to be thoroughly critiqued. I think Dr. Nasr started many, many decades ago, when he was probably a graduate student at Harvard, became really sensitive to the ecological issues. That's very, very prophetic. I think he became sensitive because he was sensitive to the human condition. This to the human condition is beyond all major organized religions. It's a spiritual force, probably informed by Sufism or some very powerful spiritual force in trying to understand this. And right now, I think maybe to share encouraging news, and even before the institute was formally established, a group in Turkey we approached by a group in Turkey. They would like to establish a chair in Sufi studies, broadly defined. The university already is very encouraging, very receptive to this idea. We're in the very beginning to try to think about it. So I hope a few years from now, Peking University will not simply a university overwhelmed by the Enlightenment mentality. It is still overwhelmed by that, with radically different visions, like Professor Nasr's visit actually last year during the Beijing Forum. It's perhaps the largest forum in China. And more than 300 eminent scholars were invited. And it is a combination of not only Peking University, but the government of Beijing, and with the support of foundations, even from foundations of in Korea. And Dr. Nasr was invited to give the keynote, and there are only two or three keynotes for this particular audience. And I was fortunate, they also arranged a dialogue. And he arrived previous day, he gave the keynote in the morning, and the dialogue with me in the afternoon, and I didn't see any sign that he was tired, and he didn't fall asleep, which to me was really rather remarkable. And maybe we should open for questions and answers. Yeah, thank you.